Welcome to SAI's core course in statistical mechanics. I'd like to start by, well, you all know Anna, who is going to be the fellow assigned to this course. Most of you may not know Sidig Gamari, who's sitting in the back. So he's actually a PhD student at McMaster, expert in theory of critical phenomena, and he'll be the TA for the course. So I'd like to remind everyone, although it's probably not necessary, that that there was a lecture zero, which I gave on September 4th, and which is recorded, and the notes are sitting on the wiki, in which I talked about you know, what the things that I thought that you should already know, or you should make yourself aware of, or you should learn, whatever's required in preparation for what we're going to do in this course, although we will introduce most things. I also said at that time that I'm trying to follow to the best I can the book by John Cardy, which I think you all have. But then in addition, of course, because I've been teaching statistical mechanics for a long time, there is this book or draft of a book that Brooks Harris and I have written, which reflects sort of the way I've always taught things in the past, and that's available to you on the wiki. So that's also a good place if you find that there's any particular knowledge that's assumed that you don't know or you don't remember. That's a really good place to go and look. Okay, so this is a course on statistical mechanics. I guess one way to think of statistical mechanics is as a way of deriving the thermodynamic properties of substances or whatever system it is from the underlying microscopics. But there's also, as you'll undoubtedly see, there's deep connections between equilibrium statistical mechanics and quantum many body theory, which can also be used, say, for calculating transport properties, things that fall slightly outside of the equilibrium statistical mechanics. And as we'll see over the next 3 weeks, there are also important connections between the theory of critical phenomena and quantum field theory, as you're learning from François David. And actually, François and I will try to coordinate our presentations so that when we're talking about the same things, or when one of us is introducing things that the other might use, that we speak a common language, and we'll see how that works. Okay, so so there are all those connections, but really the subject of this course is the theory of phase transitions in matter. And so I think we should start with a phase diagram. So let's see how well I can draw a phase diagram. Pressure, temperature, and what I'm thinking of is the phase diagram of water. Okay, so I'll put in some numbers. The scale is not very linear. So let's put in a number here, which is 4.58 millimeters. Millimeters of what? Yes. Okay, and just to make things more confusing, we'll put another number here, which is 218 atmospheres. And we'll put a very familiar number here, which is 273 Kelvin. And we'll put another number out here, which is 647 Kelvin. Okay, and now let's draw some lines. Let's see, let's start with this one. Okay. And that one comes down here. And then there's one here. That goes up there. And what have we got? We've got gas here and liquid here and solid here. Okay. And this point at 600 some degrees and 218 atmospheres is called the critical point. Probably should have written it the other way. This line is called the melting curve. And the melting curve is the line which separates gas from liquid. And when you go across this line, as we'll see in a moment, the density jumps by some significant amount because the density of the gas here is a lot lower than the density of the liquid here. Okay? So we'll come back to this many times, but you can see why this point is special, which is the end of the melting curve. It's the place where the difference between the gas and the liquid disappears. And you can see, yes, Nicole.
I think of melting as transition from solid to liquid. Is there any reason why we should call
it? Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. So you're right. This is the melting curve. Yeah, okay. So I drew this wrong. So this is the, what do they call this? Freezing. Is there a better name? No, I mean, sorry. It's the liquid gas. What is it? The, what's the name for it?
Vaporization.
Vaporization or, yeah, but there's no. Condensation, yeah, okay, condensation. Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking, but okay, this is the melting curve here, obviously. Okay. Okay, so this is the, well, I guess they call it liquid vapor coexistence. Oh, it's the coexistence curve, that's what it is. It's the curve along which let's call it that way, coexistence. You can call it all of these things except for melting. Okay, so this is the liquid gas coexistence curve. Okay, so if you're at that curve, if you're at a point on that curve, then you can have liquid and gas together. Okay, they're separate, you know, parts liquid, parts gas, they're separate, but they can exist at the same values of P and T. Okay, and this point here is a triple point. Okay, and you notice that I've drawn this one like that with an arrow at the end. This one doesn't end, okay? Do you understand why it can't end? Why would you say this one just goes up forever? Well, not forever, but yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. So this one goes, and these lines are all first order these are all first order transition lines because when you go across one of those lines, something changes abruptly, something jumps from one value to the other, like the density here as you go across from gas to liquid, or similarly, well, as you go across here, well, probably the density will certainly change, but the internal structure, the order, I mean, the solid has this crystalline long-range order, which is breaks translational and rotational symmetry, which is totally lacking in the liquid. The liquid has the property that it looks translationally invariant and rotationally invariant. Okay, there's no direction, and there's the density when you average it is uniform. Okay, so you have to go, when you go across this line, you go across it abruptly, and that's first order transition defined in terms of some derivatives of the free energy. But the point is that something jumps. Okay, and if you look at what happens along this coexistence curve, so this is T along it looks like this. That's supposed to be flat. And it vanishes with some exponent, some power law, a function of T minus TC, where this is an example of a critical exponent. Okay, so this is water. This is the place where the three phases coexist. Yeah, Nicole. Well, that's sort of the point to this course, is defining critical exponents. Okay, so I mean, this is at this point here. I'm going to be talking about this through the entire class, not to mention through the entire course. But I mean, in a sense, you should ask me this again at the end of the class. Okay. However, in this context, I would say critical exponent means that it's found that close to TC in this region, the density difference that distinguishes liquid and gas obeys a simple power law with an exponent beta. Okay, and that's what is meant. That is a partial explanation of a critical exponent. Yes? No. This is exact. This is the experimental result. I mean, not really, because of course I just drew it. But the experimentalists measure this. I mean, it's one of the easier things to measure. I mean, they've been measuring it for over 100 years. So it's not a theoretical result. And in fact, it's amazing. Like, there are many critical points in nature, and there are many quantities that you can measure, and some of the ones in, there are some systems which are easier to study than others. So for instance, the superfluid transition in liquid helium, you might think of that's not so easy to study, but low temperature physicists are very clever. And they can actually study, well, when you have power laws like this, the your ability to say it is a power law like this is connected to how large a range over which you can measure this quantity. And by a larger range, I mean it's sort of a logarithmic range. I mean, if you start with, let's write this TC to make it dimensionless, okay? So t equals 0 would be 1, and t minus tc, it's t minus tc is measured in units of tc. That gives you a dimensionless parameter. So a question you might ask is, over how many decades can I measure this quantity? Okay, because if you can measure it over many decades, then you for sure know that this is the rule. Okay, and this whole business about measuring exponents is a really rich subject in experimental physics. And because you can see, for instance, if you're going to measure this, you have to know TC very accurately. Okay, and probably there's corrections to this that you should know if you're not too close to TC, so that you can use that data along with the stuff that's ridiculously close to TC. And sometimes you can't get that close. So there's a lot of ingenuity and modeling. Understanding what's happening at these points is crucial to being able to extract this type of behavior. What is beta? Oh, for water? I forget, it's 0.33 something, but not to be confused with a third. Okay. It's just some number. And it's a number that you can, in principle, say, calculate with the epsilon expansion. Okay. It's actually, it's like a 3D icing exponent. Yeah. Okay. Yes? Say this again. Rho L, rho liquid, it's the density of the liquid, okay. Okay, it's the difference in the density of the liquid and the gas. Actually, we're going to draw that picture right now. Okay, so there's another way that you can, so now I'm just going to focus in on this part of the phase diagram. And I'm going to draw density versus pressure. So you can see, for instance, that there will be a density that corresponds to this point. Because, you know, it's just one point there, and liquid and gas are the same at that point, so they have some density. Okay, and that's the critical density rho. And then just to make it easy to draw, let me draw this. Okay. And so now I'm going to draw something called, so this is PC. I'm going to draw things called isotherms, which is lines of the density versus pressure at constant temperature. Okay? So I start off with a down here at low density and low pressure, and this is gas. And so the density changes rather quickly as I increase the pressure, because the gases are very compressible. Okay, so I can keep doing this. Now up here, say, when you're in the liquid phase, so T is less than TC in this range. And you can see, well, let's see. Let's draw some more curves here. So now you might say, well, how does this thing connect up? So if you go here, this is the isotherm for T equals TC. And then beyond that, goes like that. These are isotherms. This is the density of the liquid, and this is the density of the gas. So the point is that there's this forbidden region here. And so what this is telling you is that if, say, that you start at at high temperature and you cool down at this density, okay? When you get to this point, if you have a system at with a density in this region, as you continue to cool down, your system will separate into part liquid and part gas. And the density of the gas will go down on this side, and the density of the liquid will go down on this side. Okay? And if you're at higher temperatures, like here, then the liquid and gas are homogeneous. Okay, so what can we learn from this? The difference in density goes to zero. Rho versus P at TC has an inflection point. And yeah, Nicole. Right. So the forbidden region is that if you were to take water, okay, at high temperature, if you're somehow artificially quickly cool it into this region, it would phase separate. Okay, it couldn't actually have a uniform density that corresponds to a point inside this region. But it will phase separate into two regions, one of which has the liquid density and one of which has the gas density. That's what that means. Yeah.
Sometimes on the diagrams, they do connect the two points, right?
There's probably some construction where you figure out how much gas and how much liquid you have for a given density or something like that. There is some. But basically, this is an unstable region where liquid and gas want to. The liquid wants to be with the liquid, and the gas wants to be with gas, and that's it. Yeah.
So far, we've been talking about liquid and gas as sort of qualitative labels, but
right.
We also have quantitative graphs of them. So how exactly do you define liquid and how do you define gas? And that if I'm just given some fluid and then you ask me, is it a liquid or is it a gas? Is there some sort of measurement I can perform that tells you which, or do you have to sort of try and see whether if you raise or lower the temperature a little at phase transitions, or like how do you sort of define?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, in a sense, what this picture tells you is that in this region of, you know, you can't distinguish And you can go, by varying the temperature and pressure, you can continuously go from one to the other, okay? So in a sense, the liquid and gas, so unlike other interesting physical systems, which we'll spend a lot of time studying, like the magnetic system and the icing model, there's really no broken symmetry. I mean, just to jump ahead several steps, there's really no broken symmetry in liquid gas. And the order parameter, if you like, this is acting like the order parameter. It's the density difference between liquid and gas. But there really isn't any difference in symmetry. Okay. What do I want to say? I mean, you know, the gas is much more compressible, and it has a much lower viscosity, and the liquid, in a sense, can support, you know, compressional longitudinal modes, but the gas can too, otherwise you wouldn't hear me. So, you know, there isn't any real fundamental difference.
Like, I guess I'm kind of wondering how we decide exactly where to draw that magic dividing line.
In a sense, you can only tell when they're both there, right? I mean, when you have liquid and gas together, then you can tell. And when you can't, then they're not different. So that's just the way it is. So there's one other observation that I'd like to make about this critical point here and here, and which is a phenomenon called critical opalescence, okay? So, which is the following. If you have a system like liquid gas or mixtures of fluids where the two components have different indices of refraction, then if you're in this region here and you look at those, they'll be separate. They'll probably both be clear. For many of these systems, the liquids like water would be clear and transparent. But funny things happen, but they will have different indices of refraction, okay, because water is denser than vapor and so forth. So they're different, but as you approach the critical point, you start to see, basically your system can become sort of milky looking, okay? And basically what's happening in that, as you approach the critical point, is that there are regions, there are spatial fluctuations, there are regions of one or the other type that are correlated, that got together, and they're of order of the wavelength of light. So because they involve index of refraction fluctuations, they can scatter light. And so if you come down here, for instance, up here, you've got a homogeneous system. And you come down here, as you approach this critical point, all of a sudden, what was a nice, clear gas, whatever, starts to look milky. And that effect is greatest here. And then as you continue down, you phase separate, and the effect starts, it goes away, and you see two clear substances, the liquid and the gas, that are separated, or the two components of the two chemicals, say, that you're mixing. And I actually thought about showing you a movie of that, and I looked on the web, and the conclusion that I came to is that any one video that I found was not, actually required a lot of thought, and you had to watch it several times. And so I would encourage you to go on the web and look at videos of critical opalescence. Okay, why is that so important? What's important is it's telling you something about the nature of what happens as you approach this critical point. What it's telling you is that, as for instance, as you cool down the homogeneous substance, that's eventually going to break up into two separate phases. Locally, it's breaking up and fluctuating in the between the two phases in regions which become larger and larger in spatial extent as you approach the critical point. Okay? So what that tells you is that there's a length scale associated with the fluctuations in the density that is diverging as you approach this point. Okay? And that is related to the essential physics of critical points, which is this diverging length scale. Okay? And you don't have diverging length scales when you cross the liquid gas coexistence line, because on either side, if I've conveyed to you the idea of this correlation length, it's the size of correlated fluctuations of one or the other phase. It's short here. It only gets longer as you approach that point. Okay? But the essential physics of this critical point is all tied up in that diverging length scale. And all of the theory that we're going to develop is based on that idea that critical points involve a diverging length scale, a diverging correlation length. Okay? And what that means, it doesn't mean that all your length scales are long. It basically means that there are fluctuations on all length scales at the critical point. Whereas down here, away from the critical point, there are fluctuations on length scales up to some maximum value, which is the correlation length, but below also. And that length grows until it becomes infinite here. So that, in some ways, was pretty obvious to the experimentalists who observed critical opalescence. Well, as long as they knew about that light had a wavelength associated with it, that something like that was going on. So let's say, what are the theoretical issues? Okay, so here are some theoretical issues that are tied up in this subject. No, anything. Actually, okay, let me just make one other observation, thanks, since you brought that up. If you remember the phase diagram of the Ising ferromagnet, which we'll come back to, of course, but it was discussed in that last lecture, of H versus T. Okay. So below a certain temperature, Tc, the system spontaneously develops a magnetization, which is either up or down. This line here ends in a critical point, Tc, is rather similar in nature to this line that ends in a critical point. What's the difference? This one, of course, has some funny slope to it. And if you try to analyze the underlying microscopics or the so-called Landau theory, which you'll learn about later this week, it has a different form. So in other words, to go from this picture to this picture, you sort of have to straighten it out. Here you have a symmetry between up and down spins, which is sort of lacking in the liquid gas problem. So the remarkable thing about the relationship between these two systems is that they have the same value of beta in three dimensions. Okay? Yeah.
You were implying that you can have critical points, but you have different broken systems.
You can. Yeah, you can have a critical point. I mean, normally, this liquid gas is a little bit of a messy example because the symmetry is obscured by probably what you would call some irrelevant terms in the interactions, Okay, so it's a bit obscure, but in this case here, you have a broken symmetry. Because when you cool down in temperature in zero magnetic field, and in zero magnetic field, there's no difference between upspin and downspin. So the system, if it's going to go into a phase which is energetically favored, which is predominantly up or down, it has to decide. It has to make up its mind which one it wants to go into. And that's a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the up-down Ising symmetry. No, I didn't say that they can't have a critical point. Oh, solid and liquid. Oh, sorry, solid here? Yeah, there's no critical. There's no. Yeah. No. It's not the same thing. Here the system has to decide whether to be up and down. It's equally likely to be up and down here, and it has to decide. I see. So you're saying, okay. So what's the statement? I mean, the liquid solid transition is typically first order. Okay, you don't go continuously. Although you can imagine situations where you might. Okay, that you could have. I mean, what is the solid? The solid is like a density wave, a static density wave. Okay, and the liquid is a uniform density substance. So you can imagine that the solid. The amplitude of the density oscillation that represents the solid or crystal vanishes continuously, and then you go over to a liquid phase. Yeah, but there isn't in. I'm trying to remember the argument for. The fact that solid liquid is first order, as I recall, has to do with the nature of the order parameter in the liquid phase. It's sufficiently complicated that when you work it out, it has to go discontinuously. But say in two dimensions, two dimensions is special for melting anyway. But you can imagine systems where it does go continuously, in which case the phase diagram would look different. From this. Okay. So. Okay, phase transitions involve non-analytic behavior. So what happens at these lines represents non-analytic behavior of the thermodynamic functions. Okay, things change abruptly, even at the critical point. You get these power laws where beta is some irrational number. That's non-analytic behavior. Okay. On the other hand, the partition function for instance is analytic in beta equals 1 over t. Yeah. Nicole. Those are just two illustrations of why it's non-analytic. I mean, if you go across one of these lines, something jumps. I mean, the thermodynamic density, say, as a function of of pressure, temperature jumps. Okay, and even at this point, where things look continuous, you have these power laws which are non-analytic. So that's just two kinds of non-analytic behavior. One is discontinuous change of a function, and the other one is power irrational, or actually fractional power laws. Okay. Let's see. Well, you guys are, I'm sure, all better mathematicians than I am. How do you tell or expand it? Or whatever your favorite definition is of analytic. I don't think fractional power has cut it. Is that fair? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so this function here is pretty analytic looking, just a sum of exponentials like that. However, the one important thing about condensed matter systems is the n goes to infinity, the size or volume goes to infinity with n over v fixed, if you like. It's only the limit. I mean, the limit of this partition function and all of the thermodynamic functions that you derive from it, in the infinite volume or infinite numbers of particle system, that doesn't have to be analytic at all. And so you come to the conclusion that all of this interesting behavior is a property of large or infinite, depending on how sensitive you are to the distinction, systems. And that actually comes up clearly if, for instance, you do numerical simulations, Monte Carlo calculations, things like that. You typically work with finite systems, finite number of particles. And if you go and try to calculate something like this, you can see that it gets rounded off and behaves in an analytic fashion. Okay. So the non-analyticity is related to the infinite system size. Critical fluctuations. Diverging length scales. And also the coupling of modes at all length scales. All of these things imply that this is a difficult theoretical problem. Critical exponents. And power law behavior. A legitimate question to ask is, where do the exponents come from? When I was a student, there were no good answers to that question. Nowadays, it can be explained very neatly. There's also something called scaling, which we'll talk about a lot, and its relation to power laws. Let's leave aside what that is for the moment, what scaling is. And particularly interesting is something called universality. Which is that similar, seemingly, different systems have similar critical behavior and exponents. I might even say the same. Let's call it similar. Call it similar critical behavior and the same exponents. Okay. And so it's remarkable that the critical exponent here doesn't depend, say, on the van der Waals parameters of the interatomic potential. If you look at rare gas liquids like argon, well, helium even, argon, krypton, xenon, and so forth, and you measure this liquid gas transition, the critical behavior is the same. But even more so, if you measure, as I said, if you look at the 3D icing model and the liquid gas and a number of other systems, the critical exponents are the same. So that's called universality, and the explanation for that lies within the so-called renormalization group theory of critical phenomena. Interesting. Got to the beginning of my first lecture now. Let's see, this is the middle one. Okay, so we're doing fine. So, with that preamble, I'd like to now start getting into the theory. And the first thing that I'd like to talk about, it shouldn't surprise you at this point, is spatial correlations. In interacting systems. So equilibrium statistical mechanics. Yeah. It's just we have to do the calculation in a clever way, which sort of focuses in on these aspects that we've been talking about. But it's okay. So let's think about the two-point correlation function, which I'll call to start out with C of R and R prime, which is Okay. So this is a two-point correlation function. Okay, and this S is some local degree of freedom. And the easiest thing that it could be is an Ising spin. Which can have two values. And it could also be some scalar field, which is a function of position, would have a scalar value. Okay, but we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Ising spins because they're just nice to work with. And it doesn't matter. And this average means okay, well, this is the partition function. And hopefully everybody's comfortable with this. This Hamiltonian is for a classical spin system. Could be for a quantum system, doesn't matter. To calculate it, it matters, but to write it, it doesn't. Okay. What I've written here is if H commutes with the translation operator, or if you like, if the system is translationally, the basic underlying Hamiltonian is translationally invariant. Yes. No, outside the trace. It has to be outside the trace because basically what you're doing is you're averaging one in Z and you're averaging something, in this case, S of R, S of R prime. So this is the normalized average, right? Because otherwise it's not normalized. Z normalizes it. Oh, okay, so what do I want to say? So if the system's translationally invariant, you would expect that the two-point correlation function would only depend on the distance between the two points and not on where the two points happen to be in the system. That's, I think, corresponds intuitively to what you would think of as translational invariant system. Okay? So if you look at the correlation between the values of the spin at two points, if the system is translationally invariant, it should just depend on the distance between the spins. And this is thinking of an infinite system, so forgetting about boundary effects. Okay. So we can write this as C of R is equal to S of R plus R prime. S of R prime, and this is independent of R prime. Yeah. Ah, good point. Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, you know, it's like if it's important, I mean, if your correlation length gets to the size of the system, for instance, if it gets to be you know, 10 centimeters long, or if you're working with 10 micron systems, and it gets to be 10 microns long, which it can easily do, things change. It cares. So yeah, that's right. But there's a wide range of sizes and boundaries. And this thing here will depend on R prime when you get close to the boundary, if there's a boundary. So yeah, that's right. So the question is, what well, it depends on parameters in H. And it depends on R. So that's your spin-spin correlation function. And now we'll specialize to the ferromagnetic icing Hamiltonian. I think I probably said this, the fruit fly this of the statistical mechanics. All experiments are done on it. Let's see now. This one can go to the top. This one. And maybe I have one here. Okay, that's the icing ferromagnet. And the Hamiltonian there is minus H sum over R. SR, write it like that, minus J, sum over, write it like this, okay, and this J here is assumed positive, so that the energy is lowest when two neighboring spins are parallel, this means a sum over, this is on a lattice. Which we'll almost always take to be hypercubic, square cubic, 1D, actually, most often 1D. And then, so C of R then is just equal to trace. Can you see this? That's the front one. Go a little bit more. Oh, let's just call this Z down as a denominator. And so the question is, what does C of R look like as a function of R? What's C of R when R is zero? Yeah. Is that a question or an answer? Okay. Classical, it is classical, yeah. We can make it quantum by tricks that you'll see later, but, well, by many different tricks, but yeah, it's classical. Okay, coming back to this, what is C of zero? One, right, why is it one? Because S squared is one, right. So when R is zero, this is S squared, and S squared is one. Okay, so it starts at one. Okay? I'm going to draw it like this. And it looks, so it looks like that. Okay? And what is that? Well, first of all, I mean, just by looking at this picture, you can see that there's a characteristic length scale. We call C, which is the correlation length. Is it obvious why there's a characteristic? Is it obvious to everyone that there's a defined length scale from that picture? Why would that be? Probably. Yeah. Anyone want to venture a? Right. So if you went to calculate the average of r squared, say, you'd get a number. And the number would be some characteristic length squared. And that requires that this decay is such that the average of r squared will converge. Okay. Which isn't necessarily always true, but in depending on the dimension and the form of this thing. Yeah. Okay. What is the form? So why don't I just tell you the answer? Okay. The answer is this: that this curve goes like e to the minus r over c of t. Now, when I say it goes like that, what I mean is the following. I'm talking about, how does the correlation function decay from 1 down to here, whatever this is, which I've called m squared? So just that part of the correlation function. It goes like that. And then it depends a little bit what c is. So if the correlation length is very long, nevertheless, so if the correlation length was infinite, this is just 1, and it says that the correlations don't decay. But somehow you might expect that they do decay. They just don't decay in this way. And that's correct. What happens when this correlation length becomes very large and r is r over c is small? There is this, which is called a power law correction. And you might wonder, why do I write it in this strange way? Well, all that you should care about at this point is that it's an arbitrary power law. And if you like, whatever eta is, I mean, d is the dimensionality of the system, 2 is 2. So eta is basically what defines the power law. Okay? And I haven't said what eta is, so it's totally general at this point. Okay? So that's generic correlation function. And m here which is independent of r for an translationally invariant system. As r goes to infinity, C of r, which as we've said is S of r, what did we say? S of 0, goes to S of r, S of 0. Why is that? Is that obvious to everyone? Why would that be? Right. Yeah. That's, I mean, basically that's right. It's not that there can't be any interaction between them, because there can be interaction through an infinite number of steps that connects them in various ways. But the point is that if this is the correlation function, and so it's defining how correlated spins are at two different points, and what it's done here is said that those correlations have gone away. At beyond this distance, they aren't correlated. So this average here of two things which is uncorrelated just becomes the product of their averages. But why isn't it zero? Well, there's a number of reasons why it's not zero. For instance, you might have a magnetic field. And we had that in our Hamiltonian here. Okay? So if you have a magnetic field, it's everywhere. And so the spins everywhere are a little bit polarized along the magnetic field. They don't know about each other. They just know about the magnetic field. And so they're polarized. So they have a non-zero average value, which we call M. And that's what the correlation function just decays that value. Yes, Evelyn. There's two parts. It's this times this. Right. And typically, when you have an exponential and you're in the region where your argument's large compared to the exponential, these multiplicative power laws don't matter. Okay? But the point is when you're in the region where this thing is small, then the power law is important. Okay? And this is a very distinctive feature of these correlation functions. The fact that this, I mean, this could be, eta could be zero and d could be two, and this could be zero, this could be just one, the whole thing. That's one possibility. But typically, it isn't. It isn't. And generally, you expect that the correlations will decay somehow to zero if you're, the size of the universe apart. So something has to make that happen. Yes, ma'am. Well, the interaction itself is very short range. This interaction is only between nearest neighbor spins. Yeah. Well, okay, no, you see, this is not, the order is not necessarily short range. This is the very, when you say the previous lecture, are you talking about lecture zero or some other course? Oh, in condensed matter. Okay. Well, okay. So let me just say, I mean, I'm not precisely sure what Asa said. I'm sure whatever he said was right. But let me just tell you why I wouldn't say it exactly the way that you just said it. Okay? So where's our Ising phase diagram here? Okay, so what I said is that if h is greater than zero, no matter how small, if h is greater than zero, if there is a magnetic field, then for sure there will be a non-zero value of m everywhere. Okay? And that's separate from, this region here where there's correlations, so the correlation goes to m squared, but here it's larger than m squared because of interactions and correlations. Okay? So that's one thing which is true. Now you might say, yeah, well, what happens when h equals zero? Okay? There are two possibilities when h is zero. If you're above TC, then m is zero identically, right? Or maybe more precisely, what I should say is that m squared is zero, whereby m squared, I mean this. Okay? And then this correlation function decays to zero. However, if you're down here below TC, then it matters whether you're infinitesimally above h equals 0 or infinitesimally below h equals 0. One way or another, the spins will have an average value. And m squared, even at infinite distances, will be non-zero. And you have, in that case, you have what is called long-range order. Okay? So in fact, long-range order means, if I'm thinking correctly, what long-range order means is that this number is not zero when h is zero. Okay? So then the correlation function decays to a long distance limit. And so that's the meaning of long range order. Okay, and that's why I always draw it this way with it. Yeah, Nicole. Oh yeah, yeah, they're all the same.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. In any given case, if there's two R's, you know, one will have a prime or something. Okay. They're all the same. Yeah, because remember, we have this other picture of M well, these are supposed to be symmetrical. That what happens as you cool down in zero field, this is zero field, is that the system either decides to be up or down. Okay. So the interesting thing about this is that just because you have long range order, it doesn't mean that your correlation length is infinite. It isn't infinite. It's only infinite at the critical point. Okay? If you're above the critical point, then the correlations decay to zero exponentially with the correlation length. And if you're below the critical point in the long-range ordered state, then the correlation lengths decay to a value which is the square of the order parameter. Okay, that's the order parameter. That's a key concept in the subject of spontaneous symmetry breaking, or yeah, phase theory of phase transitions, ordering. Okay, and this, in fact, this picture then tells you what the order parameter is, what it means. It means that this is not zero even in the absence of symmetry breaking fields, like the magnetic field. Okay, so this also gives you a definition of the order parameter. So this is a very important picture because, like I say, it shows you tells you what the order parameter is, shows you the generic form at which correlations decay, and it's important to realize that it looks like this, both depending on whether this is zero or not, it still has this functional form regardless of whether you're in the ordered state or the disordered state. Okay, so let me just do one more short thing. Yeah.
Earlier, for example, you said that if you would take the expectation value of r squared, that you would get.
Oh, that was just an attempt at a cheapo definition of the correlation length. Okay, a better definition of the correlation length is that it's what enters in here.
What would you even mean with the expectation value of R squared?
Well, if you take the correlation function and use it to calculate the average of R squared, I think you'll find, if my algebra is correct, that when you average it with this function, you'll get C squared.
That's not because R is this, just the
By R, I meant R in here, that if you average, or this R, if you average R squared over the probability distribution, you get. Anyway, look, that was just a hand-waving way of saying what I really meant was that this is the correlation length, because, and this is a function which decays exponentially. No. But the power, I thought you said it's the exponential. The exponential behavior is not, and the power law behavior, as you say, is. Yeah, there's no scale. Power law behavior has no scale. Yeah, that's what's special about it.
When you say you can look at the diagram and see what the order parameter is, do you
mean the value of n? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the square root of the limit that this thing goes to. Okay, so I guess the last thing that I wanted to mention Okay. So the special properties of the critical point this correlation function has a distinct power law temperature dependence, which we will eventually calculate, which is of the form to the nu. So nu is the correlation length critical exponent. That's just definition. Obviously, it's infinite. And C of R in that case. Is that the way I wrote it before? Probably not. Where eta is another critical exponent. And at this point, when you take into account everything that I've said through this whole lecture, it should not surprise anyone that when I say that this is the essence of critical in critical phenomena, okay, and it gives you the scale invariance and conformal symmetry and all of that neat stuff. Okay, so probably this is a good place to stop, although I'm happy if there's more questions. Yeah, Daniel. Could you start over again? I didn't hear the first.
Yeah.
critical, the critical behavior appears. In this case, you're saying, is that what you mean? Or, yeah, yeah, that's one way, yeah. So you can imagine something where you have sort of an infinite number of phases converging at some point. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of things are possible, and you can certainly have, like, you know, many, say, commensurate phases at different scales. I mean, there's, yeah, lots. I think without actually thinking of a precise example of what you're saying, I'd say many things are possible. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thanks. See you tomorrow.